Morning and welcome to the studio, Dr. Stewart. It's good to have you in.
It's great to be back, Mike. It's great to be back as always.
Now, we aren't live today, Facebook Live, but if you're watching us live, we've got we're wearing some colours.
We're matching, Mike.
Good, you've got good taste.
It's taken us, thank you. As do you, clearly, because we've chosen the same colour. It's taken us a long time to match.
Now, I'm calling my shirt lilac.
Okay.
I don't know whether that's the appropriate colour title, but lilac.
Sounds like a very feminine choice of colour. I'm going with purple.
Purple. I love your purple tie.
Men, there's a bit of a meme going around on the internet that Scots can't say the word purple among... purple burglar alarm, I believe, is the... we really struggle sometimes. Some Scots struggle with purple burglar alarm. I've modulated my accent somewhat, so I seem to be doing better, but anyway...
You did that well.
But lilac is that whenever my wife wants to paint a room or whatever, you know, she comes up with these incredible, you know, autumn rose and you know, midnight mocha and all these kind of things. And I don't know what any of these. It's brown or it's tan or it's. I've got a much more limited palette. So lilac feels like it's straying into my wife's colour palette a little bit more than my comfort zone.
Well, there you go. We're in purples and lilacs today. We'd love to hear from you today, but we thought we'd just start off talking today about ADHD.
That's right.
Please tell us more, because growing up, I never heard of it.
Yeah, well, it was called different things, Mike, when we were growing up, and ADHD means or stands for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and there's a lot in that. You know, attention deficit, lack of focus, hyperactivity. Well, that sort of speaks for itself. But it covers a wide range of things. And when we were younger, one of the issues that I face when speaking to parents and patients regularly about it is people say, "Oh, but did it used to exist?" Or you know, we seem to be diagnosing it an awful lot more. There's all these people on medication. Is it really a thing? And I think the important issue is we now have criteria to diagnose it, and we are much clearer in terms of what it is, how it impacts on people, and we are moving downstream from that old notion that it didn't exist. It did exist, we just didn't treat it appropriately. So kids were just naughty, or they didn't pay attention, and often they fell by the wayside, unfortunately, whereas now we're actually looking for it much, much earlier. In fact, one of the diagnostic criteria is that several of the symptoms have to be present before the age of 12 in order for us to diagnose it. And it's something certainly that I pay attention to. When parents come in with their kids and their kids are tearing about the room, oftentimes that's just kids being excited because they can see the lollies in the jar.
Of course.
Or a bunch of ducks, which is another story. But sometimes it's pointing to a greater issue, and it allows me to lead into that conversation with the parents.
98.5 weekdays with Mike. Dr. Stewart is in the studio. It's good to talk to you again, Dr. Stewart. We started off talking to ADHD.
Yes.
What does it... You mentioned a lot of people come in and the kids start, you know, running crazy in your practice.
That's not diagnostic, incidentally. That's my kids do that often too.
A lot of kids do.
Yeah.
But what does it actually look like? What are some of the signs?
So it can be subtle, and that's important. And so we don't rush a diagnosis in something like this. And in fact... I would never make a diagnosis of ADHD, nor should any GP really. At least at the moment, the advice is it should be done by a specialist in ADHD. For children, that would be a paediatrician, and for adults, that would be a psychiatrist. But there are certainly criteria that they would look to. And you need a number of these criteria. It's not just one or two things. You need six or so. But things like people who fail to give... there's two different types, as I mentioned before. There's the inattentive, the poor focus, if you like, and they're people who maybe don't give close attention to the details of things, whether that's at work or in their school work. They're people who have trouble holding attention or on play or other things like that. They don't seem to listen when people are speaking to them. They seem to be easily distractible. They don't follow instructions very well. They have trouble organizing tasks. They're avoidant of things that require a lot of mental input over a sustained period of time, often forgetful, that kind of thing. Whereas the hyperactive side, they're obviously fidgeting, tapping their hands or their feet. That's often me if I've had a few too many coffees that day. They often jump out their seat in totally inappropriate situations. So, and again, we do see that in the surgery. You know, a kid who's perhaps... a GP surgery is not necessarily the most formal of environments, but especially if you've not not met that child before. Mm. Often they are a little bit reticent to be themselves. They will sit quietly, generally beside the parent. If you've got a kid who's very forward, who's up jumping about, running about, that could potentially be a sign that there's an issue there. They often climb or run about in situations where it's not appropriate. And in adolescents and in older people, that can often be more like feeling restless rather than necessarily running about. They're often on the go and driven by a motor kind of thing is how people express the concern they have. Talk excessively, they blurt out answers before questions, these kind of things. So it's a bit non-specific, Mike. There's no one thing that would make me say that's ADHD. But there are a number of criteria that we kind of are constantly juggling in our heads when we're thinking about these things. Oftentimes it's teachers who will say to a parent, I wonder if you should maybe go and speak to your doctor and see if there's something going on here. And one of the criteria, as I mentioned earlier, is that these symptoms generally have to be present before the age of 12, although a lot of people don't actually turn up until they're adults and then start talking about these issues that they've been having for a very long time.
I was going to ask you that, because do you often get adults coming to see you concerned that they do have it?
Very much.
For years
yeah,
later?
Absolutely. And sometimes people will know someone who's got ADHD, and they've said, oh, you know, a lot of symptoms. I've had college lecturers, for example, who had students come forward to them and say, oh, just so that you know, I've been diagnosed with ADHD. I'm on my medication and it's working really well, but these are the ways it impacts me. And the college lecturers have come forward to me and gone, well, I never thought about it, but I think I might have ADHD because this person was telling me. Mm. Other people will potentially have tried the medication that their friends have been taking because they've been recommended to, you know, friends will say, oh, I think you've got ADHD, try some of this. Now, I would strongly encourage people not to do that, obviously, but certainly if people come forward and say, oh, you know, I tried the medication and it worked, that's very much something I would take seriously, and we would probably refer them on for further evaluation.
Interesting. We'll take a break. We'll come back and chat some more. Dr. Stewart, ADHD, you've done the diagnosis.
Yep.
I
haven't. The paediatrician or the psychiatrist has, but yes.
Where to from there?
Well, before we actually get to the diagnosis, I would probably do a few tests. We would certainly be looking at doing a referral to, as I say, if it's a child, we'd be looking at a paediatrician. If it was an adult, we'd be looking to a psychiatrist. But I'd probably want to do some blood tests, depending on the age of the person, because some of these things can be related to certain medical conditions, for example, iron deficiencies or thyroid disorders, these kind of things. And so we'd probably look into that in the first instance. And then based on that, we may do some questionnaires and things in the surgery. And then, as I say, we would do referrals. But it's not just, as you say, once the diagnosis is made, it's not just, that's not the end of the story. There may or may not be treatment that's offered. And then that's something that the GP can help with. There are issues around funding. And ADHD, in particular, people who are not diagnosed as a child, it can be harder to attract funding and NDIS support and all these kind of things. So that's an issue that we often have to discuss and work our way through. But we may need to speak to psychologists, we may need to speak to occupational therapists and social workers, dietitians, physiotherapists. Lots of people often are involved depending on the symptoms that patients present with. There's a strong association between ADHD and anxiety. And around about 30% of patients with ADHD will also have a coexisting anxiety, which may need to be dealt with separately. Well, it will often need to be dealt with separately. And interestingly, hypermobility, so joint hypermobility, we see quite frequently coexisting. And it's an interesting sort of genetic association. So it's something I look for when I'm thinking about that diagnosis. And if it's present, then it's supportive more of that possibility as well. And there's a longer term view to be taken on this as well. Obviously, if it's a child, then mum and dad and siblings will probably need some support through this. There are a number of really good organisations. The one in particular that springs to mind is an organisation called ADHDWA, who are doing an incredible amount of work in this field and to advocate for sufferers of ADHD. And GPs do a power of work in that area as well. So engaging early with a GP if there are any concerns is really important, and making sure that we're there for the whole family to help support them through the diagnosis and onwards beyond.
Because I would imagine that diagnosis could take some time. I mean, as you mentioned the criteria earlier,
yeah.
that could take some time.
It does sometimes. And actually, that therein lies some of the rub, because there can be some expense associated with that as well, depending on the age of the person and how obvious it is. There may be a more detailed assessment required by a psychologist or psychiatrist in order to be absolutely definitive, yes, this is what we're dealing with.
Okay.
And then we move on from there. So, yeah, and it can be an expensive process, but it can be a time-consuming process. But ultimately, for the patients, the important thing is arriving at the diagnosis, not because we can slap a label on their forehead, but because then we can explain to them and their families and the people around them, here is how they are going to struggle with these issues, and here's how we can support them.
Determining whether it is a diagnosis for ADHD, because as you were mentioning some of the criteria earlier, I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm ticking a few of those boxes.
You and me both, mate, fortunately not all of them.
no, that's but interesting, like in thinking about kids,
yeah.
I'm thinking, okay, well, that to me, that kind of sounds kind of what a normal kid's behaviour would look like.
And that's a fair, that's a very fair comment, but actually a lot of these the criteria have some overarching features which basically say that this has to be impacting significantly on the child's performance in multiple domains, so school, home, wherever,
gotcha.
and also that they've been persistent and that they are out with the norms of their peers, and so it's not a developmental stage, for example. So you wouldn't, an average 3-year-old, for example, will run around and terrorise the place and not have any issues, whereas you wouldn't expect that of a 10 or 11-year-old who would potentially, you would expect to be a lot more restrained in certain social circumstances. So it's not a one-size-fits-all, and I was just giving a brief summary of those criteria. And I think it's important to recognise that we absolutely do not jump at a diagnosis of this. It takes a great degree of input in order to arrive at a diagnosis if it's appropriate. And we're all the while we're looking for other reasons, other causes, other potential things that could be going on, in the hope that it's not where we're heading, that it could be something else that's arguably important to treat, but we're checking to make sure we're getting the diagnosis right.
It's good. Dr. Stewart, we'll take a break. We'll come back and chat some more. You are on 98.5. Back after Taylor Swift. 98.5, this is Weekdays with Mike. Dr. Stewart is in the studio. Good morning. Is that Paz?
Yes, it is.
Good morning, Paz.
Good morning, Mike.
Yeah, good. You got a question for Dr. Stewart this morning?
Yes, I have. You mentioned about NDIS funding. We've got a child, it's 10-year-old, so been dealing with ADHD issue from his age about 4. And so we're visiting the community of ADHD WA, and everybody basically always told us that there is no chance to get any NDIS funding based on ADHD. So whether Dr. Stewart got any experience, so how to present the case, you know, to possibly reach out for the help from NDIS.
Sure. Okay, great question, Paz.
It is a good question, Mike, and it's a perpetual problem, unfortunately, for many families living with ADHD throughout WA. The short answer is no. I'm afraid I don't have any specific specific triggers that I could recommend, but there are a couple of courses of action I can certainly recommend. NDIS funding essentially requires an additional diagnosis on top of the ADHD in order to more easily attract funding, so that may be an avenue that we can look down. But in essence, I would suggest speaking to your local politicians and raising the awareness of this issue. I know that ADHD WA are doing a good job in that field, but every little bit helps in that area in order to try and push the awareness and make the politicians more aware of the lack of funding and the lack of support for people who are very much impacted by this. And those people who, particularly those who have a very bad outcome from ADHD, they tend to have a very poor educational outcome, which means they tend to not be contributing as much in terms of taxes to society, and potentially can become more of a drain on society than anything else. It's a very broad generalisation, but at the same time, it's a very real concern for a number of people that if we don't fund this, if we don't manage this appropriately from a very early age, if we do that appropriately, these people have an excellent outcome, and with treatment, they can have very, very positive educational experiences. But those people who have been cast aside and feel as though they're on the byline of society tend to have a much worse outcome, and that has a much greater cost to the public purse than anything else, Mike. So
here we go, Pez.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have anything very specific, but
get on to your local member, state and federal, or
absolutely. I think a bit of both would definitely help, but making it very much more aware in the politician's eyes would be helpful.
Good on you, Paz. Good call there. Thank you. On the running to be our weekday's winner tomorrow. Dr. Stewart, we are nearly out of time. It's been great having you. Now, do you want me to diagnose anything for your throat? You're going okay?
You noticed that, did you, mate?
I did. It's a little bit scratchy today. Okay?
I'll be honest with you, Mike. I was at my kids' inter-school carnival yesterday. Both my kids were running in the track events, and I was screaming my lungs out, as any crazy parent will identify with. And
I love it.
It was a wonderful day. And actually, the reason that I was screaming quite so loud it was a send off for a lovely, lovely teacher called Mrs. Gilbert, who has been
which school?
This is Carey Baptist College in Forestdale.
Oh yes,
and she's she is a wonderful, wonderful inspiration to so many children, not least of which to my son, who is absolutely beside himself that she's moving back to America in a week's time. And the Gilbert family are an inspiration, and that's there's another story there. But they're a very sporty family, but they are moving on to bigger and better things, and America's gain is very definitely WA's loss.
So big shout out to Mrs. Gilbert, Carey Baptist. That's the newer campus.
That's the newer campus, yes.
Yeah, we did a broadcast down there a few years ago.
I think we should do that again, Mike. That'd be fun.
It's a great little, it feels like you're out in the middle of nowhere out there, but it's also growing.
It's growing big. You'd be surprised how big it is now.
98.5, Dr. Stewart, we had to get you back.
Yeah, I nearly got to the car park there,
You nearly got to the car park, but we've got a really good question that's just come in via the text line from, I think it's Wanjuku from Wembley. He says, I've got a question for Dr. Stewart. A friend's son has been diagnosed with ADHD, and she is concerned about the use of dexamphetamines.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that? You thought it was a pretty important question.
It's an important question, Mike. And this is, I would say, the number one concern that parents have is, wait a minute, you know, they're just going to chuck my kids on these stimulants. I don't want that. And my answer is, fair enough. That's a very legitimate concern. But what I would say is, hear us out. Yeah. This is, medication is always the parent's or the patient's discretion. Yeah, if we make a recommendation, if I give you a course of antibiotics, it's your decision whether you want to take it or not. Mm. And the same goes for these kind of medications. There are a number of medication choices that can be made in the sphere of treating ADHD. Stimulants is one of them, but there are non-stimulant medications which are used as well. And if you have concerns about stimulants, I would urge you to speak to your GP, speak to the pediatrician or psychiatrist who makes the diagnosis, and then hear what they have to say on why they are making the recommendation that they are. If you say, I absolutely don't want it, they will try and work with you in order to find an alternative. And at the end of the day, if you don't like the opinion that you receive, go and ask for a second opinion. That's one of the most commonly recommended courses of action that I take. And it's often soothing. It's often good to be able to go and speak to someone else who says, do you know what? I think you've been given good advice. I think that's reasonable. And I think I would follow that and see how it goes. The other thing that we can talk up to in that domain is that you can use it as a test of cure. And if you say, okay, well, we'll try it for a month, 2 months, 3 months, and we'll see where we're at, you would do that in conjunction with the doctor, because they would give you some recommendation as to how long they expected before you saw a response. But if you give it a period of time and you're not happy, then of course we don't continue a treatment if it's not effective. We need to find another way at that point.